bienvenidos a toda mi gente escuchando en Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM in Occupied Washington, El Distrito Colombia, here on this Friday, November 28th, 2025. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show. That is at LMC underscore show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we put the spotlight on Brazil following the shocking police raid in a Rio de Janeiro favela that left at least 120 people dead last October. And so joining us today is Brian Meir, who's an author and Brazil correspondent for Telesur English. He joins us on the show for the first time today from Brazil. Welcome to the show, Brian Meir.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So I have to say that it's very hard to know where to begin in discussing this gruesome act of state violence in Brazil. So what I'll do is I'll start with a brief news summary by France 24 News on October 29th, summarizing what took place. So let's take a listen.
It's a gruesome lineup on a main road of Complexo de Penha, one of Rio's largest favelas. These residents lay out the lifeless bodies of their neighbors a day after the bloodiest anti-gang operation in the city's history. The raid mobilized 2,500 law enforcement officers to combat the territorial expansion of Comando Vermelho, Rio's main criminal organization, which operates in these densely populated working-class neighborhoods. While police raids are frequent, Tuesday's operation was shocking in its scale and human toll. Some residents denounced what they called executions.
The government paid for this, to carry out this massacre. They have to pay for it. They can't destroy so many lives, so many families, and get away with it.
Is that right? What kind of operation is this? What has changed? Did they introduce any sports, any studies, anything to improve the lives of young people? They haven't changed anything.
Tuesday, a steady stream of vehicles arrived at these hospital doors, carrying bodies and those wounded by gunfire. The right-wing governor of Rio State initially announced that 60 criminals had been neutralized, but state police now count more than 100 people killed, including several police officers.
Yesterday we delivered a hard blow to crime, showing that we are capable of winning battles, capable of playing our part. But we also have the humility and certainty to recognize that this war will not be won alone.
So again, that was in October 29th, France 24 News, brief summary on what took place in this favela in Rio de Janeiro last month. And since that time, there have been more revelations with regards to this police raid. So for example, according to Reuters on November 10th, quote, none of the 117 people killed by police were among the 69 suspects named by prosecutors in the complaint providing the basis for the raid, end quote. In addition, quote, only five of those named in the criminal complaint were arrested that day, and none were senior leaders of the notorious Comando Vermelho gang, according to a Reuters review of the full police report on the operation shared with the Brazilian Supreme Court, end quote. So, again, a lot more developments have come out since this raid took place last month. So can you tell us about the stated intent of this police raid versus the actual reality and actual results as it pertains to organized crime? Because we did hear some families of the victims speak out angry over what took place here.
I moved to Brazil, to Rio de Janeiro, in 1991. And over the years, I've spent about 8 years there. My son still lives there. I spent a year filming a documentary with BBC called Welcome to Rio, entirely in favelas. And I've been to a lot of these favelas, and I've interacted with a lot of people, including members of drug gangs and stuff, because we had to get authorization from the drug gangs to film inside of the favelas and everything, right? These kinds of attacks where the police come in shooting in favelas are routine in Rio de Janeiro and have been since the 1980s. A lot of times it's partially psychological. It's to maintain the residents in a state of constant terror. It's a kind of harassment. But Governor Claudio Castro, who is a staunch ally of imprisoned President Jair Bolsonaro, former president, he's now responsible for four of the five worst police massacres in Rio de Janeiro history, you know, in his 3 years as governor, 4 years as governor, sorry. This strategy of coming into the favela shooting basically started in the 1980s, employing U.S.-style war on drugs rhetoric. You know, and what's changed this year is that, first of all, it's an election year next year for governor. And so Claudio Castro wants to be reelected. And it's good for publicity. 57% of the residents of Rio de Janeiro supported the massacre. Rio de Janeiro has a very racist, historically racist middle class that a lot of people just seem to think everyone in the favela should be killed. But what's different about this one is that a coalition of far right-wing governors have got together and tried to push through a measure declaring these drug trafficking gangs as terrorist groups to appeal to Donald Trump, who's done similar things in Mexico and Venezuela and Colombia. And they think it's a way to get support back that they seem to be losing from the international far right and Steve Bannon and the Trump administration. So they've been lobbying with members of Congress and the Senate to try and push a bill through that would have this group declared, this and the other major drug trafficking factions in Brazil declared terrorists. So they would authorize U.S. military operations inside of Brazil, which they hope would weaken the, you know, or even get rid of Lula and the Lula administration. So this massacre happened, you know, in the midst of this lobbying effort that's going on, and in a way that it kind of like strengthens their position with Congress. So in addition to this idea of trying to get support from Trump to leverage against the Lula administration, it's also an election year next year, and being tough on crime, as everyone in the U.S. knows as well, it's a good way to get reelected when you have a bunch of constituents who don't have any empathy for anybody.
Yeah, it's hard to not only invoke the name of Trump here in this conversation, but also just the very thoughts of how he sort of dominates our conscience and our orbit politically and socially as well, especially in the context of these sort of violent acts that took place in Brazil, in the context of Rio de Janeiro as well. And just to support what you said at the beginning, which is these sort of raids have been going on for such a long time. Next year is going to mark the 20th anniversary of this show on WPFW. And as far back as 2016, we've been talking about these sort of raids taking place in Rio de Janeiro that would leave not necessarily this amount of people dead, but a significant amount in almost time after time in case after case. It's quite stunning and even more shocking that there is a large percentage of the Brazilian middle class, as you just said, that supports this. Now, at the center of this tragedy, and we heard it in the clip at the beginning, is that of Rio de Janeiro Governor Claudio Castro. Can you tell us more about who he is and how his governance at the state level is different from the federal for American audiences who may not know?
Yeah, it's a good point to explain how the police operate in Brazil, because whenever something like this happens and a left-wing government is in charge, they try to blame the president, just as if it would be like if there was a big shooting in the United States, let's say in St. Louis or something, if the press would blame the president for that shooting that took place in the city of St. Louis. In Brazil, Brazil has three police forces, the federal police, which are like the FBI. They're controlled by the presidency and they're controlled by the federal government. And you have the civil and the military police. These are both controlled by the state governor. And so every state, even though they're kind of connected to the military nationally, they're controlled by the governor. They have a very loose link to the military, even though military police is in their name. The military police were initially founded in different times in different states from the late 1700s to the early 1800s. And one of their main functions was obviously to capture escaped slaves. Like many police forces in the United States were first created. And there's never been any real effort in most states to kind of remove that core element of racism in their entire essence, their entire being. But during the military government, the military dictatorship, which was installed with the United States support and supported by the U.S.
Yeah.
from 1964 to 1985, some of the state police forces developed their own death squads that were operating, you know, to support activities from the dictatorship, executing political prisoners, disappearing political activists, labor union leaders, and whatnot, and also practicing a lot of torture. And the two main death squads, institutionalized death squads in Brazil, are the Rota in São Paulo and the BOPE in Rio de Janeiro. And when the dictatorship finally fell, the deal that was struck to guarantee a transition to democratic rule gave all of the military and all of the police amnesty for any of the crimes committed during the dictatorship. And although they briefly toyed with the idea of eliminating the Rota in São Paulo, after a few months they brought it back, they never disbanded the BOPE. Okay? Since the dictatorship, the military police do not respond to the regular rule of law. They operate outside of the law. When their officers commit crimes, they are judged in their own military police courts. And if they're held guilty, they're held in military police prisons. And so as you can imagine, the record that United States police departments have at self-regulating in cities like Chicago, where I come from and stuff, isn't very good. Imagine a system like that. In addition, you have a situation in Rio de Janeiro where it's a very unusual local context compared to the rest of the country. For example, in São Paulo, you have one big drug trafficking faction that was founded with help from people from the Gamora who were in jail in 1987 in a city called Tabuate, and they structure it like the mafia. And so you don't see them when you go into favelas in São Paulo. They're around, but you don't. If you see them, they don't have guns on them. Rio has three different factions of drug trafficking gangs constantly fighting with each other, and now several paramilitary militias that were started by military police officers and are made up of off-duty military police officers who've moved in and taken over favelas and charge extortion from local merchants and things like that. One of the three drug factions in Rio, the Amigos dos Amigos, or the Friends of the Friends, was literally founded by two military police officers. And the military police in Rio will often rent their equipment and their services out from one faction to attack another faction. So there have been moments when I lived in Rio 10 years ago, whatever, when it was discovered that like the police had rented out these armored vehicles that they use to a drug trafficking faction to invade a rival favela. And they're completely infiltrated. It's the most corrupt police force in Brazil. And the police violence level in Rio is much, much higher than any other state in the country of Brazil. It's just like outrageous. Like São Paulo has double the population of Rio de Janeiro, and they average a couple hundred police killings a year, whereas Rio de Janeiro officially always averages over 1,000, sometimes 2,000, sometimes deaths from undetermined causes are in the thousands, and a lot of those are taken to be like police executions. So the situation there, and obviously none of the leaders of these gangs live in the favelas. The federal police just made a big raid on the PCC, which is the big gang base of São Paulo, and they found that they had set up their own hedge fund, and they arrested a bunch of bankers involved with the PCC and several of the leaders of the PCC. When they go into favelas like this in Rio, they're shooting like low-level street dealers, you know, who are very well-armed because of the gang violence situation. A lot of them armed with machine guns and stuff like that. But they're street-level drug dealers. None of the bosses live in the favelas. So it's not, they've been doing this for 40 years now, and it's never made any kind of dent whatsoever in organized crime in Rio de Janeiro. It's just done for the headlines, for publicity, and unfortunately, as Rio de Janeiro is the center of Bolsonarism and has a large number of former military and military people living in Rio, it's the former capital. Unfortunately, it's good. It helps candidates get elected. You know, there's a lot of people who fight against it, But this is like 40% of the city that is revolted by this kind of stuff.
Not only that, but we should also point out that the favelas are not the ones that are manufacturing arms or producing the actual drugs in the favelas. That's somewhere else. And you're right, there should be a greater emphasis on the financial aspect of these drug cartels and these drug organizations, not the favelas, because as you just said, they are the soldiers in these sort of organizations. Now, it just dawned on me. You mentioned earlier that 4 to 5 worst police shootings have taken place in Rio de Janeiro under the leadership of Governor Cláudio Castro. As you said that, it sort of dawned on me that perhaps for an American audience, is it fair to compare his actions to that of, say, for example, Texas Governor Greg Abbott? Because one thing that comes to mind for me is that some of the worst mass shootings in the United States have taken place in Texas. So it's a crude parallel, perhaps, but is it a fair one?
Well, I'm sure that they have a lot of ideological common ground. Aside from Cláudio Castro being a conservative Catholic from the charismatic movement, I mean, they have a lot in common with these evangelical Christians on this kind of stuff. Basically, a common thread among these governors who support Bolsonaro is that they've slashed funding for intelligence and they've spent a lot of funding on better weapons for the police. And I think there's a lot of police departments in the U.S. that probably operate. I don't know that much about Texas. I've been living in Brazil 30 years, but I would assume that that's a kind of policy that he supports, like de-emphasizing the intelligence part of it and increasing the weaponry and the general harassment and oppression of poor people in the poor neighborhoods and stuff.
Yeah, not to mention the fact that he sort of has the same bluster and sort of demeaning, dehumanizing way of talking to poor working class people. As say, for example, even a Tom Homan, the quote-unquote border czar here in the U.S. So in an October 30th report by Al Jazeera, they sort of interviewed a crime reporter who was quoted as saying that police operations in which more than 20 people die are very rare, quote unquote, his words, not mine, in Brazil. And most of those happen in Rio. And to prove the point, that same report cited Jacarezinho and Alemão as a frame of reference, two other favelas that also had deadly police raids. As horrendous as this particular raid was this past October, does it serve as a microcosm to the over-militarization over the years of the Rio de Janeiro police, especially following the images of bombed out buildings on fire? Obviously, we're on the radio, but people can go on Google and on YouTube and they could see buildings, residential buildings, completely bombed out. And there are certain images and scenes that kind of look like war zones in another country. And going back to Cláudio Castro, I don't know how you could have that many people die, innocent people die, and see images of bombed out residential buildings and make the conclusion that it was a successful operation. It just doesn't fit with the reality of what we see with our own eyes.
In terms of like military equipment and stuff, this was, now his first police massacre took place in Jacarezinho, right? At the time, that was the worst police massacre in Brazilian history. Now it's this one that took place in Alemão and Peña. They started using prison terminology to describe favelas in Rio. So they call them complexes now. So it's the Alemão complex and the Peña complex. They're really like 5 or 6 favelas, one next to the other. But this was one of the first raids, or massacres, I should say. I'm not going to use the word raid, in which they used drones dropping hand grenades and stuff. You know, they have armored helicopters with snipers in them. And I think part of the modus operandi to justify this as a success is that two people like him and his supporters, many of whom claim to be Christians, the people who live in favelas aren't human. They're completely dehumanized. So it doesn't matter if he kills the target or not. If they kill anyone in there, it's good. Just as when I first moved to Rio in the 1990s, there was a wave of murders of homeless children And this was also supported by a large percentage of the population in Rio de Janeiro. You know, it's just complete dehumanization. And part of it's racial. Part of it is racial legacy from slavery. Part of it's a legacy of this wave of migration of people from the Northeast during these massive droughts. And so you have some favelas where, like, you go in there and almost everybody's black. And then other favelas where everybody's from the Northeast, newer favelas. And there you see people, white people, light brown skin, different skin tones, you know, different types of people. But to the citizen, you know, to the long-term residents whose families have been living in Rio for hundreds of years, it's all the same. None of those people are human. None of the people in the favela are they're subhumans, so they should all just be wiped out. You know, so this is why I remember drinking with some buddies. At the time, my wife was working with a woman from a favela behind our building or whatever, and we was up there drinking. And they told me one time the BOPI just came in and shot like 10 random teenagers and then just made up fake drug dealer names for them and brought and called the press and did a press conference with these dead bodies and stuff like that. They just go in and, like, the BOPI, when they go into neighborhoods on any kind of police action, they'll always kill at least two random people just to maintain. It's like an Israeli counterinsurgency tactic to maintain the climate of fear. And they have a loudspeaker system in their armored vehicle, so when it comes into the neighborhoods, it's transmitting things like, I'm going to get your soul and stuff like that, scaring kids. They don't have any respect for school hours. They come in shooting from their helicopters sometimes when school's getting out. And then when some kids get killed or something, they're, oh, we're sorry, whatever. So it's a really bad situation in Rio de Janeiro. It's really disgusting. And it's one of the reasons I personally ended up moving out of that place. But the solution to this kind of just basically like neo-Nazi level police violence and the actual logo of the BOPI is the SS skull with the two daggers pushed through it. That's on the side of their vehicles. So when I say Nazi, I'm not exaggerating. The only solution for this, really, according to the Workers' Party and the black movements in Brazil and human rights activists and everything, the only solution is to eliminate the military police. Because even though in other cities they don't do things as bad as Rio, they come pretty close sometimes. You know, there are police massacres in Pará in the last couple of years where they killed 40 or 50 people. And there are massacres where they just hide a bunch of the bodies and you never find out how many people died. And that happens in Rio too. And so over the last 25 years, the Workers' Party, Lula's party, has attempted to present constitutional amendments to eliminate the military police 3 times. Each time they've done it, it's been blocked by conservative members of the governing coalition because the Workers' Party has never had more than 22% of Congress. There's 29 political parties represented in Congress. In order to govern, he has to give cabinet positions to politicians from center-right parties. And every time the PT has tried to change the Constitution, it's been blocked. So it's really this kind of situation that's really complicated to resolve. The president can't just wave his magic wand and issue a decree ending the military police. But the consensus among human rights activists, the black movements, labor unions, social movements in general, is that the only solution for it is eliminating the military police.
That is a scary thing to think about as far as how difficult it is to eliminate this particular police, especially with the extensive history of extrajudicial killings of people of color, as you just described. It's scary for an American audience as well, because even before this second incarnation of the Trump administration, there were calls by grassroots organizations to try to abolish ICE. And now it's gotten even worse than before, and perhaps gotten to the point where it may not be any other government after Trump may not be able to abolish it altogether. Now, we're going to take a break momentarily, but before we do, correct me if I'm wrong, but since you mentioned that police in the past have tried to hide bodies, wasn't there an attempt to do that in a wooded area near this Favela Peña last month? And also...
Exactly, yes.
And also, the whole city was at a standstill. I think there was a report also that the airport was shut down in addition to public transportation throughout the city.
Yeah, because the major highway between the airport and downtown goes pretty close to Peña Favela, where part of the operation was going on. And yeah, they found dozens of bodies in a forest who looked like they had their hands tied behind their back and were executed at close range, not in any kind of confrontation situation. This is a very common thing in Rio de Janeiro as well. And in other places around Brazil too, but especially bad in Rio.
Yes, and again, I'll reiterate what I said at the beginning of the show from this Reuters report, which is that none of the 117 people killed by police were among the 69 suspects named by prosecutors in the complaint, providing the basis for the raid. So we're going to take a break right here. We're speaking with Brian Meir, who's an author and the Brazil correspondent for Telesur English. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM in occupied Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned. That was Geraldo Vandre, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM in occupied Washington. Reminding everyone that you also follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're speaking about the Peña massacre in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, with Brian Meir, who's an author and Brazil correspondent for Telesur English. So, Brian, in the early days following the deadly police raid, several news outlets pointed out that the raid also occurred just days before the United Nations climate summit known as COP30. Why do you suppose this connection is important in the larger context of what took place last month? Because at first glance, I didn't see the connection, but then it occurred to me, oh, wait, there was a similar raid, not to the same extent that was what we saw in October, but there were similar ones before the Olympics in Rio and also before the World Cup several years ago. So again, can you connect this to the larger context of what we're discussing here?
Yeah, in this case, I don't think there's very much relationship at all. I think it's related to two main things. First, Cláudio Castro worried that the mayor is going to run against him in the gubernatorial election next year. The mayor is very popular right now, Eduardo Paes. So for his selfish, opportunistic electoral interests, he killed 121 people officially, maybe more And secondly, because of this group of far-right Bolsonarista governors who are trying to convince the Trump administration to declare Brazil's drug trafficking gangs as terrorist organizations. In this case, you know, in the case of the Olympics and the World Cup, those were events happening in the city of Rio de Janeiro. But Belém, where the UN COP 30 conference took place, is thousands of miles away. And I don't think there's much of a relationship. If there was any relationship at all, it was not, you know, it wasn't top level. Maybe it was like, oh, we'll also embarrass the Lula government in the lead up to COP 30. But I don't think the press really treated it that way. So I don't think in this case there was much of a relationship.
Well, perhaps you may have answered my next question already, because on your Twitter account, you mentioned somebody by the name of Marcelo Freixos. So who is Marcelo Freixos, and could you explain his denunciation of the actions of Cláudio Castro as quote-unquote electioneering? You may have sort of answered that, but can you tell us who he is as well?
Well, he's actually one of my sources for saying that it was election-related. Marcelo Freixos, right now, he's the national minister or secretary of tourism. However, he is a legendary figure in Rio de Janeiro politics. He was for a long time affiliated with the left-wing PSOL party, and as state congressman, he's the first person to take on the paramilitary militias. So he led a parliamentary investigation into the militias, and his protege, Marielle Franco, after he was a city councilman, so when he moved up to state congress and stuff, he helped Marielle Franco get elected city councilor, and she was trying to do the same kinds of things, taking on the paramilitary militias at the municipal level that he was doing at the state level. And that's the main reason, which I believe she was killed. But, you know, he's run for mayor twice and come close. But like I said, it's only about 40-45% of Rio's population that's actually progressive. People don't realize it because of its party reputation, but it's the first state in Brazil that had a majority evangelical Christian population, and it's the heart of Bolsonaro and his people. So he went to the federal government 3 years ago, but anything he says about Rio de Janeiro politics is still extremely relevant because he knows it inside and out. And he accused Cláudio Castro of playing electoral politics, which is the same thing that several other prominent politicians did. Nationally, the Workers' Party criticized him for that. And it's because, simply, as the polls showed afterwards, 57% of the population supported that activity. And there's a percentage of the population that probably didn't support it fully, but still generally supports the idea of this governor who sends his police into favelas to control and to kill people and stuff like that. Maybe some people are like, thought it was a little too excessive, but still support in general his tough-on-crime stance, which is ironic because these kinds of police chiefs, I'll compare them to a U.S. police chief here, but these kinds of leaders of police forces who are the most tough-on-crime, a lot of times the crime rate ends up going up under their rulership. I mean, the governor of São Paulo acts the same way as Cláudio Castro. He's basically Bolsonaro's number two guy, Tarcísio Freitas. And the murder rate, he's also employed the same tactics. He's had massacres where they killed like 40 or 50 people, but police killings went up almost 100% during the first 3 years of his government. And the murder rate stabilized. The theft rate went down by like 7 or 8%, but lower than the national average. And the rape rate in the state of São Paulo went up by like 60%.
Oh my God.
The rape of children went up like 40 or 50% because he gutted the budget for intelligence and just based it all on like press opportunities where he can show up at the scene of a police action and talk about and put on a police jacket and talk about how tough he is on a crime. It's for his own electoral purposes. These people aren't really that interested. In fact, the worst thing for them would be for crime to disappear because they wouldn't have any electoral strategy anymore.
It sounds like they're cosplaying like Kristi Noem.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And also, like, he's actually literally a criminal. He's under investigation for 11 cases of bribery in a case he keeps appealing, but it's working its way through the court system. So he's himself is a criminal, allegedly, right? I mean, he's being put on trial for committing crimes himself.
Well, speaking of criminals, the focus of this conversation today is on the massacre that took place in Rio, but we cannot ignore what's taking place this week. Even as we have this conversation this week, former President Jair Bolsonaro has now been ordered to start his 27-year prison term for plotting a coup against his own country. Now, again, the focus here is on the massacre that took place last month, but I want to get your thoughts on this ruling of him to start his 27-year prison term, whether or not it's connected to what we're discussing here.
Well, it's just connected in the sense that Bolsonaro is a very close ally of Claudio Castro, you know, and yes, he's from Rio. So basically, the media in the U.S. is treating this story in an interesting way, you know, because like to the Democrats, I think the Democratic affiliated media, it's really important to show that Bolsonaro is the Brazilian Trump and that he tried to do what Trump did. But in Brazil, they actually punished him. Why can't Americans punish Trump? You know, and then conservatives are, and especially disseminating disinformation spread by people like Glenn Greenwald, are trying to spread this idea that it wasn't as bad as the January 6th Capitol invasion. It's a witch hunt and Bolsonaro shouldn't be in jail and this and that. It's important to point out that this was a much more serious attempt at a coup d'etat than anything that happened in the U.S. They uncovered thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of evidence, testimonies from witnesses, written plans. One of the generals arrested today, Augusto Heleno, he'd written out all the plans for the coup on a notebook, you know, a paper notebook, because he's like 78 years old. He had the entire notes from all the meetings. The Bolsonaro's aide-de-camp forgot to empty the trash folder in his PC, so they found all of his emails and everything. And basically, they spent 2 years plotting, first, an auto coup to maintain Bolsonaro in power. And the way that they did that was by working with this kind of social media network of right-wing bloggers under the command of Carlos Bolsonaro and also Paulo Figueiredo, who's been hiding in the U.S. for a couple of years, who's become this kind of like spokesman for Brazil to the Republicans and stuff, to delegitimize the Supreme Court itself, the Electoral Court, and the electronic voting system. So that this was done very systematic over the course of 2 years. And Bolsonaro held a press conference in which he used public television. It wasn't even a press conference, a televised event on national public television, in which he spent an hour saying that the elections were going to be stolen, that he had proof the electronic voting system could be hacked into. And for this, he was barred from running for office for 8 years because it's abuse of power. He harnessed the state's communications network to make accusations without providing any proof about the electronic voting system. In fact, he commissioned the military to study the vulnerability of the voting system. And when the results were that it couldn't be hacked into, he hid the results of the study. So they had been planning all of this. On Christmas Eve, one of the allies of Bolsonaro, who had been camping out in front of a military base with a group of people demanding a military coup, he was arrested trying to blow off a bomb attached to a kerosene truck in Brasilia Airport. There was a mob a couple days later that attacked the federal police headquarters with Molotov cocktails. And then on the day that Lula arrived before the elections to get his credentials, they attacked the hotel he was staying in with Molotov cocktails. And basically, there's all this evidence that shows that they met with all of the commanders of the military to try and get them on board with an auto coup to keep Bolsonaro from leaving office after he lost the election. The head of the Navy and the head of the Air Force agreed to go along with it. The chief of the Army disagreed. He refused, right? But the Army is like over twice as big as the Air Force and Navy combined. So at that point, they realized that wasn't going to exactly work. And so they went to kind of like this plan C of trying to get this riot going on January 8th. And the idea behind that, as they found on written records, minutes from meetings and stuff like that, was they were hoping that Lula would declare a state of emergency. If he declared a state of emergency, that automatically turns control of national security over to the military. And at that point, someone from the Air Force or the Navy was going to arrest Lula, Vice President Alckmin, and one of the Supreme Court ministers, and they were going to just announce that the military was going to form a transitionary government until they could hold new elections. So Lula, to his credit, he didn't declare a state of emergency. He knew what they were going to do. So he just ordered the federal police over to the only police force he controls, over to the capital area, and they cleared the place out in like 20 minutes with tear gas. It was a little more complicated than what happened in Washington, D.C., you know? And so in that sense, I don't want to sound like I'm defending Trump or anything, you know, but it's just not the same thing. You know, it kind of like oversimplifies. Unlike the U.S., Brazil has a history of military coups. It's already had two successful military coups and multiple failed military coups. The U.S., you know, they had General Smedley Butler helped Fernando Delano Roosevelt stave off some kind of coup in the 1930s. That's the last time we've ever had anything similar to that happen in the U.S., I guess. So I guess that's one point about it. And then the other point is just that he tried to escape early Saturday morning. He tried to take off his ankle bracelet.
Yeah, I was about to mention that he actually on film, on video, admitted to trying to break his ankle bracelet, correct?
Okay, so what's come out in the last couple of hours is the following, which is it's just ridiculous. I just wonder what the hell was going through these federal police's heads when they let him stay in this mansion under house arrest. Everyone has been saying like, oh, he was planning, there was going to be some commotion created by a protest in front of his house that his son was calling for, and he was going to slip out and like make a beeline for the American or Argentine embassy, like 15 minutes away by car. They've uncovered there's an airstrip, a private airport, private airstrip, 200 meters from his mansion, owned by the family of Nelson Piquet, the Formula One racer who was one of Bolsonaro's biggest campaign donors and who's already been tied up in a corruption scandal with Bolsonaro. 200 really? Meters. They had an airplane ready, waiting from 200 meters away. So all he had to do was get through that ankle bracelet. He could have run there if he wasn't such a pathetic, out of shape guy.
Oh, man, as if we needed any more proof of his criminality here. And I think there's more to that story, as you just mentioned. So I feel like that's a 1 hour conversation in and of itself. So
for sure. But let me just say, the point is about the ankle bracelet stuff. It's all irrelevant now because his actual prison term has started anyway. So he hasn't been preemptively arrested anymore. Now he's actually serving his time.
Well, it's good to have some degree of justice in this world during these times. So that's good to know at the very least. So as we have this conversation today, going back to the police raid in Rio de Janeiro, Rio de Janeiro's public safety secretary, Victor dos Santos, who oversees the police, was quoted as saying that more raids like the one in Peña will take place. So amid the talks of more military-style raids, what can you tell us about the lack of effort to not only address the financial apparatus of drug cartels, but also putting more resources basically into more pertinent things like public education, public transportation, public health care? Because it seems to me, and I've dealt with this scenario in various other countries on various episodes that we've done on the show, is that it's a lot easier to shoot a gun than it is to teach a child how to read or how to do mathematics. And so it just lends another component to the moral bankruptcy, I would say, to the people who make the decisions to militarize, over-militarize, remilitarize the police in one form or another. And perhaps another question to add to that is, could we see the same thing happen here in the U.S. as far as these sort of deadly raids?
The different police forces have different functions in Brazil, right? So like investigative police are the civil police. They're the detectives. They do the investigations. And the military police are only supposed to come in to execute warrants, to stop crimes while they're happening and things like that. In a functional system like that, there would have to be much better communication between the different forces. It seems like the military police just do whatever they want. But the fact is, since these are trans, these big mafias, they operate in multiple states and multiple countries in many cases, you really need the federal police, which is the equivalent of the FBI, to aggressively go after these drug gangs. And so at the same time that these far-right governors are pressuring Congress and the Senate to introduce legislation to declare the drug trafficking gangs as terrorist organizations, they're also introducing legislation to weaken the federal police, to weaken their ability to go after drug trafficking gang leaders. And it's because these drug trafficking gangs are infiltrated into the right-wing political parties and the establishment, the financial establishment of Brazil. You know, so it's clear that they're not interested in actually solving the problem of drug trafficking gangs. If they were, they would be doing it in a different way. It's not a question of like, oh, somebody just needs to explain to them a better way to do it. They're making money off of this whole situation. They like it the way it is. They gain more political power this way. And so that's what makes it makes it hard to fight when a powerful group of political interests is doing everything it can to kind of like maintain the situation the way it is right now. The first thing you said, I just agree with you, you know, regarding could we see something like this happening in the US? If you're talking about a armed group that acts clandestinely, like these legalized death squads associated with the military police in Rio de Janeiro, the BOPI, you know, that doesn't respond to the regular rule of law, you know, that isn't judged in a regular court, can't be thrown in a regular jail or something like that, doesn't respond to, can't be sued. You know, the closest thing I think we have to that in the US is ICE, right? I mean, ICE is like a secret masked police force. A lot of these military special forces guys wear masks too. And so I feel like ICE is kind of like, you could say the military police in Brazil operate in a state of exception. They don't answer to the regular rule of law. And ICE is acting that way in the United States right now. And so maybe they don't have the same modus operandi. ICE is not just going in and massacring people. It's kidnapping people. The military police are actually like massacring people. But the fact that both groups operate in a state of exception outside of the regular rule of law is very similar. And in both cases, I would say that it's an example of fascism. And I don't use the word fascism lightly. I'm not just someone who says like everybody's a fascist or something. I'm saying based on historical, you know, tradition of fascism, you look at how fascist governments, policing forces operated, and it's very similar, if not almost identical.
Yeah, you know, usually towards the end of the show, I would ask guests, what else can we learn from this sort of event? But considering that the people in power who set all these tragic chains of events in motion, openly declaring that there are going to be similar events happening again in the future, you know, gives me great cause for concern. In addition to what you mentioned during the course of this conversation, you also mentioned the idea of the state of exception. And I have to say that as the son of Salvadoran immigrants, that definitely hits pretty hard considering the authoritarianism that we see in El Salvador under the Bukele administration. So I think perhaps maybe it's a more justified comparison to compare the police with what's going on in El Salvador, in addition to the parallels that we can make with the US. So with that said, we are out of time. We've been speaking with Brian Meir, who's an author and a Brazil correspondent for Telesur English. So, Brian, I've been following your work for some time. I really admire what you do. Keep up the great work, and thank you very much for being on the show with us.
All right, thanks for having me. And maybe if you want to help out somehow, try and get the International Criminal Court to investigate Governor Cláudio Castro from Rio de Janeiro for crimes against humanity.
Absolutely, among other people.
Yes.
And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone that you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
inviting all D.C. hand dancers, Philly boppers, Chicago steppers, Carolina shaggers, and West Coast swingers. The Treehouse Dreamers venue offers dance music from Motown and more every Friday, 1 to 5 p.m. at 4722 14th Street Northwest. DJ Jammin' Dave and other fine DJs provide an atmosphere offering seniors socialization while getting much-needed quality movement through familiar tunes and dance every Friday. Details at 301-922-4064. That's 301-922-4064. WPFW offering wellness through dance, one activity at a time.
If you're a dancer or just a fan, the Way You Move Festival is coming to Washington, D.C. with jams, competitions, and classes. December 13th through the 16th. Whether you're into hip-hop, house, breaking, popping, or locking, we've got you covered with top-notch Small Fries Edition, all-styles dance jam and competition for youth ages 17 and under on the 13th at Edgewood Arts Center. Freshest of all time, 2 vs. 2 breaking battle, ages 18 and up, also on the 13th at the Black Cat. The world-famous Juice DeBoo 2 vs. 2 competition, DC prelims, on the 14th at the Reach. And masterclasses with international Juice DeBoo judges on the 15th and 16th. All in Washington, D.C., all family-friendly, December 13th through 16th. Additional event and registration information at wblinc.org/thewayyoumove. Brought to you by the Words, Beats, and Life nonprofit.
In 1977, the D.C. cultural landscape changed for the better when WPFW joined the airwaves and D.C. space opened their doors. On Sunday, November the 30th, a reunion party is happening at the Atlantis Club featuring Marshall Allen, Luke Stewart, Little Red and the Renegades, Bob Boylan, and more. They'll be celebrating a time when D.C. space was the place where music and politics merge to change Washington, D.C. Doors open at 5 p.m. Details at theatlantis.com. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
On Monday, December 8th, WPFW presents Saving Our Homes, the Crisis in Housing and Homeownership, in partnership with the Washington Informer and the Missionary Baptist Minister Conference of the DMV. From 9 a.m. until 1 p.m., we confront gentrification, predatory buyers, tax sales, foreclosure traps, and the loss of family homes, defending our elders, and keeping generational wealth in our families. The programming continues at 5 p.m., where we'll unpack the lack of affordable housing and the displacement of renters. We culminate in a town hall from 6 to 8 p.m., moderated by Donald Temple and Denise Rolock Barnes, where we welcome listeners' calls. Guests include lawyers, activists, pastors, financial strategists, and government officials. That's Saving Our Homes, the Crisis in Housing and Home Ownership, December 8th on WPFW, building a more equitable world, one broadcast at a time.
Hi, I'm Dr. Nick, and you are tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
I'm John Cain, and this is Resistance Radio. I want to thank you for joining me.